Now coming up, another difficult week for the Bush administration. But first, another new twist in the story of the former Russian spy and fierce critic of the Russian government who died after being poisoned. One of the last people to see Alexander Litvinenko before he became sick has also tested positive for the same toxin that killed Litvinenko. According to British media reports, Italian espionage expert Marlo Scaramella, who met Litvinenko at a sushi restaurant in London the day Litvinenko fell ill, also now has significant amounts of polonium-210, the radioactive element, in his body. Edward Lucas is Central and Eastern European correspondent for The Economist magazine in London. He spoke with us yesterday and joins us again today. Edward, tell us more about this new development. First of all, what more do we know about Scaramella's condition?
Well, we don't know anything more about Scaramella's condition, Robin, except this news that he does have some polonium in his body. Mr. Scaramella is a very mysterious character. He's an Italian specialist, as he describes himself, on the activities of the Russian security services, and is a consultant to an Italian parliamentary committee about what the KGB was up to in Italy during the Cold War. He's not, I think it'd be fair to say, universally regarded as a completely reliable source on these things. But he did indeed meet Mr. Litvinenko in this famous sushi bar right next to the Economist's offices here in London.
And we also read that he said a couple weeks ago, he was quoted as saying in British media that he brought an email to that lunch from one of his sources. And in that email, that source claimed to know who killed the Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. And that email also had an assassination hit list with both of the men's names on it, Scaramella and Litvinenko.
That's exactly right. And, I mean, it's true that Mr. Litvinenko said he was a bit puzzled why Mr. Scaramella felt it necessary to deliver this email in person. And that led to some people to think that maybe Mr. Scaramella had some hand in this, which, of course, he denies. What we don't know is whether Mr. Scaramella was actually a target of poisoning or whether maybe the polonium was administered to Mr. Litvinenko, but Mr. Scaramella, being close by at the time, perhaps got some, perhaps if it was sprayed over their food or something, that the majority went to Mr. Litvinenko and a little bit's gone to Mr. Scaramella. We just don't know that. It was puzzling also. Mr. Scaramella had said earlier that he was quite convinced he hadn't been poisoned. He was in the best of health, but he's at an undisclosed location somewhere in Britain being looked after by the British security forces at the moment.
Looked after is one way of putting it. he might be, you know, it might be sort of a, he's being protective, in protective custody. And by the way, reports that we've read said he did not eat at that meal. But we also know that there's been a letter released by a former Russian security officer who claims he also warned Litvinenko about that hit list and a death squad. And who is supposed to be behind that hit list or part of that death squad?
Group of ex-FSB and KGB officers called Honor and Dignity.
These are the Russian security agents.
The FSB is the new version of the KGB, which mainly operates inside Russia, but now also abroad. And it's said that there's a group in St. Petersburg of agents who work under the name of Honor and Dignity, who've taken it upon themselves to go around rubbing out the opponents of the regime for whatever reason. This, I must say, sounds very strange to me, and I'm always very suspicious at this sort of stage in anything involving Russia and the secret services, because I suspect that whatever we think we know is probably not right, and the crucial ingredient is somewhere out there, and we may not learn it till later, if at all. It's very hard to fit the poisoning of Mr. Litvinenko, the alleged poisoning of Mr. Gaidar, and the shooting of Mrs. Politkovskaya all into the same picture.
Right. Let's remind ourselves, Mr. Gaidar was yesterday's news. He's the former prime minister who fell ill while speaking in Ireland. He also has been shown to have poisoning. And when you say it's hard to put all these disparate characters together, his daughter is... He's more of a moderate critic of the Putin administration, but his daughter is quite an activist, and she says she thinks it might have been a leftist who's been doing the poisoning to, you know, place the blame on the Putin government. So it's quite complicated.
It is. I mean, it really is a kind of looking glass world where when something bad happens, you say this is done by the enemy of the person who's accused of doing it in order to discredit them. But I do think Mr. Gaidar is a very establishment figure in Moscow. He's a moderate critic of the Putin administration. He's pleased about some things they've done, less pleased about others. His daughter runs a fairly insignificant, I must say, although commendable in my view, opposition group in Russia. A very big contrast between him and Mrs. Politkovskaya, who is a sort of crusading opposition journalist, a very fierce critic of the Kremlin, and Mr. Litvinenko, who was a defector from the security services and, you know, was really a completely outside the political mainstream and a big fan of the exiled billionaire Boris Berezovsky. So I think all we can really say is watch this space. There's going to be more.
Watch this space. Well, in the meantime, just one last thought from you, Edward, because analysts are also saying that this convoluted, complicated story is a part of a grab for wealth and power in Russia that is out of control. That's a recent Boston Globe editorial. Do you have the same thoughts?
I think everything that's happened since 1991 in Russia is a grab for wealth and power that's been out of control. It's just that now it's involving murder. It could be people trying to topple Putin. It could be people trying to embarrass him. It could be people trying to shift him into their camp. It could be people trying to replace him. It could be Putin himself. Any possible explanation will fit the facts. My view is to go for the simplest one, which is the Kremlin, broadly described, intimidating its opponents. But it is quite hard to stretch that round the Gaidar case.
Well, as you said, watch this space. Edward Lucas, Central and Eastern Europe correspondent for The Economist magazine, speaking to us from London about the story that gets curiouser and curiouser involving the former Russian spy who died after being poisoned. He claims by the Russian government. They deny it. Edward, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Bye-bye.
Bring U.S. combat troops home from Iraq in just over a year. That is reportedly one of the recommendations of the Congressionally Commissioned Iraq Study Group, and that they will present to President Bush next week. Today's Washington Post reports that under that scenario, an increased number of U.S. advisors, troops training Iraqi soldiers, would stay in Iraq, perhaps for years. Well, Republicans and Democrats on the panel reportedly had a hard time agreeing on anything bolder, and that may not be what President Bush chooses to do. But what about the next occupant of the White House? This week, Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, a Democrat, became the first candidate to officially declare he's running. He's in New Hampshire today. Is he not Hillary enough to win? That's the headline of an article from John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and Washington Wire columnist for The Wall Street Journal. He's going to join us today to take a couple of minutes to look at things Washington. John, welcome as always.
Hey there. How you doing, Robin?
Good. We're also welcoming Anna Marie Cox, Washington editor for Time magazine. She's been here before as well. She's the blogger formerly known as Wonkette. Anna, welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
And is it for the Bush administration, though? Anna, let's start with you. What a week. Racing around the country.
The world.
And just wonder, how would you sum it up? For instance, President Bush said at the end of this week that a graceful exit from Iraq is not realistic. Of course, the mind immediately, the next part of that sentence is, what are you thinking, an ungraceful exit?
Well, the idea that he ever thought, you know, it passed, you know, a couple of years ago even, that there would be a way to do a graceful exit. The opportunity for a graceful exit, I think, ended as soon as, you know, the looters broke into the Baghdad Museum. I mean, it was going to be messy no matter what. And, of course, we had one arm of the administration saying that was just fine. Rumsfeld, you know, sort of arguing that, well, that's just the way democracy works. But definitely we're seeing a president struggle with being the only person left in the room who has any kind of view about Iraq besides it being an utter disaster.
John Harwood, do you agree? And is it just a matter of the definition of exit? What do you think the president is saying? And who is he saying it to? Is he saying it to the Iraq Study Group?
Look, I think the president's becoming increasingly isolated on this issue. He sent some signals right after the election that he wanted to hear new ideas. He was trying to accommodate to the fact that Democrats now share power with him in Washington. But it feels as if the president thinks he's being railroaded and is about to be railroaded by the Iraq Study Group, Jim Baker, and the sort of whole realist school of American foreign policy making, and the congressional Democrats, and he's standing up and putting up a stop sign. The question is it realistic for him to try to sustain that position. He's got to think not only about what happens in 2007 and 2008, but what happens beyond, and make sure that he can lay a basis for his policy that can be sustained beyond his own term in office.
He's also hearing, or it seems that it's percolating up even more from the trenches, if you will, than it did at the midterm elections. We had a moment here that we were conscious of in Boston. A conservative talk show host here, Jay Severin, went on the national IMUS in the morning program and read a manifesto calling for the impeachment of President Bush for mismanaging the war. This is from someone in the media and also a former Republican consultant who strongly advocated for the war. And this is, you know, a big turnaround. Is that kind of percolating happening across the country?
Well, impeachment's not going to happen, and I wouldn't say impeachment's percolating around the country, but it is a straw in the wind of the fact that the president's support base on this issue and other issues, frankly, is just much smaller than it's been in the past. And you know, he's got an adjustment process of trying to come to terms with what it means both to deal with a Congress controlled by the opposition and a much, much smaller base of public support within the country at large.
Yeah. Anna Marie, another thing that the Iraq Study Group is going to be calling for is the diplomacy. We've been hearing this drumbeat for weeks now, and talks with Iran and Syria. In fact, even a conference. What is the thinking about how possible that's going to be with this administration?
I think that's going to be a challenge to Bush on both like a personal and diplomatic level. I think that it's very. I think he's created a presidency that's all about black and white. He's very proud of that. He's proud of not being a diplomat. He's proud of having called terrorist evildoers, and having created, the catchphrase of his entire administration, the axis of evil. And to now have to go back and talk to Iran, one of the members of the original axis of evil, and ask for their help, I think is going to be something that's very hard for him to do. He's always embraced this idea that he's a cowboy. And I think that you can change your set of advisors, you can change the way that you present your ideas in public, but you can't change the sort of essential character of this president.
Well, and by the way, to give credit or blame where it's due, the phrase actually came from one of his neoconservative advisors, but you're right, he's holding on to that.
He's embraced that way of looking at the world. And the one thing I think, John is right, the Iraq Study Group is sort of embodies the way his president, his father ran his presidency, both kind of in the very makeup of the people on the study group and in their approach to dealing with the problem. And I think the sounds that he's been making, he's been saying, we're not going to outsource diplomacy, we're going to put our own stamp on whatever their recommendations are. He's clearly creating a narrative that's going to allow him to completely reject what they say if he so chooses.
John,
I think we have to be mindful of. Bob Gates still hasn't taken charge at the Pentagon, and when that happens, he comes out of that Iraq study group, he comes out of his father's circle of advisors, he's going to have a seat at the table, which may change some of the dynamic within the administration.
Bob Gates, the former CIA man who's the new nominee to replace Donald Rumsfeld, he'll be testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee on Tuesday. Next week's going to be an interesting week. Next year is going to be an interesting year. John Harwood, stay right there. Anna Marie Cox, you stay there as well. We'll take a quick break and look ahead. That's when we come back here and now. We're talking the week that was and what's ahead in Washington on Here and Now. And we're speaking with Anna Marie Cox, Washington editor for Time magazine, formerly The Wonkette, and John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. And John, I want to pick up with you because in the week ahead, we've got on Wednesday the Iraq Study Group report, what's left of it that people don't already know, from the leaks. And on Tuesday, as you said, the nomination hearings for Robert Gates, President Bush's nominee to replace Donald Rumsfeld. Just briefly, what do you think is going to jump out on Tuesday from those hearings?
On Gates?
Yeah.
Oh, people will explore in detail whatever he's willing to say about the situation in Iraq and try to figure out whether or not he's going to show any leg. I suspect he won't, and that the administration won't want him to.
When you say show leg, he's been a critic.
Yes. What I mean is they would try to draw him out as to his personal views about how Rumsfeld has run the war, what the strengths and weaknesses of the policy, and I think you can expect in a circumstance of that kind that he would do modified limited hangout, and to use the old Nixon phrase, and not say too much because they wouldn't, the administration wouldn't want him to. But the question is, you know, how willing are they to tolerate vague answers? He's going to be approved overwhelmingly. Yeah. Everybody knows that. So this is mostly about trying to put some stuff on the record that the Democrats hope will allow them to keep pressing the administration where they want him to go.
And Anna Marie, real quick, what's the thinking about if, you know, when approved, how well he's going to work with this administration?
Well, I think there's a hope that he has some kind of, he brings credibility from the past administration, and that he also, it's like, what's kind of, we have to, Bush did this huge thing of getting rid of Rumsfeld, so this has to work at this point. Like, where are we going to go next if it doesn't work with Gates? And I think, if not Bush, then I do think there is going to be a shift in the people around him and realizing that this is really, you know, it's a sort of desperate time.
You know, I have to just take one second, because I want to get to the Democrats and the candidates for president. But I just, when you say that, there's this feeling of what are we going to do? What is the mood in Washington? John, Anne Marie, both of you jump in. What are we going to do next? I mean, there's a war going on. Is it as unsettling as it should feel?
I think that the people that I talk to definitely feel unsettled by it. I was going to say something earlier when we were talking about people, Republicans critical of the president, which is, at this point, it's kind of, there's no cost to Republicans being critical of the president's handling of the war in Iraq right now. He's not running again, and it's the least popular issue, you know, right out there. And I think one thing that I see that's sort of even more interesting is the depth of emotion that people are showing about it. This is a town that doesn't get very emotional about things. I think a lot of people paid very... Jim Webb's, the anecdote about Jim Webb's exchange with the president, I guess it was last week. You both are familiar with this story, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of emotional weight of that exchange, I think, really captured people's imagination.
This was when the president and Webb were at a reception together?
Right.
Is that what you're referring to?
That's right. And then he asked Webb, how's your boy, who's a Marine fighting in Iraq? And Webb said, you know, basically that's none of your business. You know, it's between me and my boy. And
right. Well, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, you're talking about some of the politics of it, Anne Marie. But, John, just real quick, I mean, you know, this sense that there's a broken country. And, you know, millions of displaced Iraqis and the death toll. I mean, does that seep in or is it still staying on the political level?
Oh, it's totally seeped in.
Yeah.
And I think people are scared, frankly, because it's not just that the administration seems not to know what to do. I don't think the administration's critics are all that confident in what they're recommending. Mm-hmm. Phase withdrawal, you know, what's that going to leave behind? Nobody feels very good about this. And even the American public, which is very critical of the war, when we've asked them in our Journal NBC poll repeatedly, do you want a rapid pullout of U.S. troops? They say no.
Right.
Do you want the war to come to an end? They say yes, but they don't really know how to do it.
Right. So who might be the person in 2 years from now who is taking a look at this? Let's take a quick look at the presidential race, which is heating up. Tom Vilsack, the first candidate to throw his hat in the race, an orphan who became governor, you know, quite a story. But, John, you write about whether he is not Hillary enough. What do you mean by that?
Well, the race right now is about Hillary Clinton and everybody else. Who's going to step up and become the alternative? Usually in races, even ones with strong front runners, someone emerges and has a moment in which it's possible that they can knock that person out. Gary Hart had it against Walter Mondale in 84, didn't quite do it. Bill Bradley couldn't do it against Al Gore. John McCain couldn't do it against George W. Bush. Who's going to be that person to challenge Hillary Clinton? Barack Obama seems most likely if he and she both get into the race, neither of which is certain right now. But you've got a whole outer tier of people, Vilsack, Bill Richardson, Evan Bayh, Joe Biden, all of whom have strengths and weaknesses, who are going to have their moment in this race. And Tom Vilsack wasn't letting the grass grow under his feet. Not that the grass is growing in the wintry Midwest today.
Well, Anna Marie, I just want to touch on another name. Barack Obama, of course, he's second in polling, I believe, to Hillary Clinton.
Which is an amazing thing. We have to just stop and pause and look at how long he's been on the national screen versus how long Hillary's been on the national screen to be second right now. Is it truly remarkable achievement?
But he's all, you know, some people are finding what they would see to be flaws in what seemed to be, you know, the saintly image that was presented at the Democratic convention when he first burst on the scene. He's riling some evangelical Christians. He's an abortion rights supporter, but he's speaking at a conference today, in fact, at Reverend Rick Warren's California megachurch, saying he respects differing views on abortion. So there's a little bit of heat.
Well, generated. I don't think there's any loss for Obama to appear at Saddleback Church for this AIDS conference. I think that is actually it's probably a winning situation for both Rick Warren to the extent that he is a political, you know, player, and he is somewhat of a political player these days, yeah. And it's a winning situation for Barack. I think Americans are ultimately pragmatic people, and I think the idea that you would need to talk across the aisle to solve something that's such an overwhelming crisis as, you know, the global AIDS situation, I don't think shocks people. I think that people understand that that you need to get both the sort of Bill Clinton organization about AIDS and the Rick Warren organization talking to each other, or else you don't come up with a solution. I do want to add, though, that I think that the Obama for President meme is something that...
Meme, that means a viral idea. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a viral idea. Yeah. It's something that has probably done a lot more to help his book sales, and maybe it's intended to help his book sales more than it's an actual idea. And I also want to throw some cold water on the Hillary thing if I have some time.
Just do it in 5 seconds.
She has 97% of people in the American country already made up their mind about Hillary Clinton. That 3% that don't, haven't made up their mind, that's too little to play with in order to get a presidential nomination.
Okay, last word, Annemarie Cox, the blogger formerly known as Wonkette, now Time Magazine Washington editor, John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. We welcome you as always as well. And we'll check in with you again. Thank you both.
Have a great
Thank
weekend.
You.
You too. More ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now. It seemed more like a soccer match than a presidential inauguration in Mexico City today. Fights broke out and chairs were thrown on the floor of the Mexican Congress as opponents of incoming President Felipe Calderon tried to block the podium where he was supposed to be sworn in. Here's a clip from Mexican radio as cheers and shears broke out after Calderon took the oath of office. At one point, someone walked away with the podium. Calderon's opponent in the July election, Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador, claims he is the legitimate winner of the election. He organized this protest and has set up a shadow government. Joining us now is Shannon O'Neill, adjunct fellow of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Shannon, have you seen anything like this? I mean, this was astonishing.
This is something new for Mexico, at least in the democratic period, to have this type of unrest, particularly on the floor of the Congress.
But it's been going on for days. There's been scuffles. Calderon's opponents, supporters of Obrador, camped out at the podium prior to today. Just give us the thumbnail. Why are they making their stand there?
There have been protests going on in Mexico since the elections last in July. And the reason is that the opposition candidate, López Obrador, believes that he won the election. Calderon won with less than 250,000 votes. So there are a lot of people in Mexico that aren't sure about this election.
Right. Obrador is the leftist. In fact, he even gave himself a faux inauguration in November, but 100,000 people turned out.
It's true. In fact, today in the main square in Mexico, the Zocalo, there's another 100,000 people with López Obrador. Today was just an extreme example of the governance problems that Calderon's going to face. One is López Obrador and this mass mobilization ability he has with this alternative government. If he doesn't like the policies the government's trying to push or the decisions that are made, he can quickly mobilize these demonstrations and, you know, block traffic in Mexico City and really wreak some havoc. I mean, other issues that Calderon faces is actually the president's power in Mexico is quite limited, so he's going to have to work with Congress to get anything passed. And in Congress, he holds a minority, so he's going to have to work closely, probably most likely with the PRI, the centrist party, in order of structuring new legislation. That said, you know, Calderon is a well-known and fairly astute political operator, and so he is reaching out to these other parties, and he may be able to cobble together coalitions, particularly on certain policy issues.
What does the turmoil in Mexico mean for the United States and for relations? And further, what does the fact that he is a more right-leaning, if you will, president than Fox was, what does that mean?
For the United States, I think this is good news. Calderon will definitely continue our free trade agreement, NAFTA, with the United States, and we'll work together in terms of opening markets.
Well, I have to stop you there because some people don't think NAFTA is such a good thing.
Well, you know, I think it is good for overall trade. good for Mexico and it is good for the United States. These relations between the two countries are important. It's important in Mexico for creating jobs and stabilizing the economy in Mexico, which will limit the other problems we have, particularly issues of migration.
Okay, we just have to throw in that though a lot of people are saying that, in fact, what Mexico is doing is sending a lot of its business overseas to even cheaper factories, and that U.S. Companies are setting up terrible factories along the border with the U.S. because of the free trade agreement, and the working conditions are terrible.
I mean, that's part of the NAFTA agreement, and those are part of the issues that Calderon will need to negotiate with the United States. But there are labor rules installed which need to be better implemented, but that's something that the countries can work together on with this newly installed president.
And you were also touching on the flow of illegal immigrants from Mexico to the U.S. How will Calderon impact that, if at all?
Mexican politicians across the board, the left, center, and right, so including Calderon, have a fairly strong feelings about migration and policy. All of them want policies that include earned citizenship for the Mexicans who are already here, as well as some sort of guest worker program. So this is what Mexico wants, and we'll be working through diplomacy and through official channels with the United States to try to negotiate.
Well, while we have you, we also want to touch on this weekend's elections in Venezuela, where controversial President Hugo Chavez is expected to win re-election. He, of course, the outspoken critic of President Bush, called Bush the devil while giving his speech at the UN this fall. How has his view of the U.S. affected his popularity?
Hugo Chavez is popular in Venezuela with particular segments of the population, both for his stance, his anti-American stance, but also for his domestic policies. And really what he's focused on, or has been, is using oil money to build lots of social programs within the country. And that's really the base of his popularity. But of course, looking and standing up to the regional hegemon always wins you some points with certain segments of the population.
By the way, Shannon, we're curious, how do Venezuelans feel about Hugo Chavez giving oil to what they would probably perceive as wealthy Americans? Here they're considered, in many cases, Americans in need. He's, probably doing it in part to make a political statement. How do they feel about that?
Sure. Well, some of them support them for exactly that, for the political statement. But that was actually an issue for the opposition, which gained a lot of traction, was why are we sending our money abroad when there's so much poverty and problems here in Venezuela?
What about the region? There's growing concern in the U.S. that Chavez may be the new leader of an emerging leftist movement in Latin America. But you paint that picture a little differently.
Well, actually, looking at the different leftist leaders in Latin America, Hugo Chavez is actually quite isolated. The other leaders we see, the newly elected leader of Chile, of Argentina, of Uruguay, of Lula in Brazil, these are all a different left, and this is a more social democratic left in the European tradition. That means they're trying to balance market-friendly policies with more socially oriented policies, providing a social safety net to their population. So they're balancing both of these things. So this is really the left of the future in Latin America.
As opposed to perhaps, nationalizing companies and not having much of the free market?
Exactly. Chavez really represents the left of the past. It's a much more populist, socialist past, and he's really a holdover that's being propped up with the oil money that he has.
How much is the passion of the leftists in Mexico who are disputing the president who was inaugurated today, how much is their leftist passion ignited by Hugo Chavez, or is there no connection?
You know what? There's really no connection. Calderon tried to make a connection during the campaigns, but there's no connection. The left in Mexico really arises out of domestic issues and arises out of the extreme poverty levels in some areas and the extreme inequality within the country.
Shannon O'Neill, adjunct fellow of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, who's had quite a day watching the inauguration in Mexico as chairs and podiums flew when new President Felipe Calderon was sworn in. Shannon, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure.
And this quick news note, Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is facing questions about hiring illegal immigrants to do lawn work at his home. The Boston Globe reports today that the immigrants worked for a company that Romney has hired for the past decade. A spokesperson for the governor says he knew nothing about the immigration status of the workers. Romney, who's considering a run for president, has called for tougher immigration laws. He wants a fence built along the border with Mexico, penalties for employers who knowingly hire illegal immigrants. He's also called for National Guard troops to be stationed along the Mexican border. We'll continue to follow that story. Still to come today, a former truck driver and bounty hunter hears the Angels sing and turns tenor for a new CD of Christmas music. Carl Tanner's incredible story, that's still to come. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, now a side note to a top story of ours reports that Italian security expert who met with an ex-KGB agent, Alexander Litvinenko, before he died from radiation poisoning, has now also tested positive for polonium-210, the substance that killed Litvinenko. Well, an autopsy on the body of the former Russian spy, Litvinenko, began today, so there may soon be answers to this story that reads like mystery fiction. And indeed, poisoning as a murder weapon has a long history in the mystery genre. And joining us to talk more about that is Rosemary Herbert. She's editor-in-chief of the Oxford Companion to Crime and Mystery Writing. Rosemary, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. This is a really thrilling story in the pages of the newspaper. It does read like fiction, but we have to also take it quite seriously.
Yeah, we don't want to treat this lightly. It sounds like an awful way to die. But as you say, poisoning certainly not unfamiliar to mystery readers. And you are very familiar with the whole spectrum. We spoke to you recently about your new omnibus of crime. So tell us, how common is it in mystery writing that someone is poisoned?
It is very common. In fact, in the 66 novels of Agatha Christie, more than half of them show people employing poisons as a means literally to the end.
Huh. Well, when the Litvinenko story first came out, it was believed that it was thallium poisoning that had killed him, and I understand you know of a Christie story where that does happen.
Yes, there's a Christie novel called The Pale Horse. It was published in 1961. And Christie was quite upset later on to learn that there was a criminal in Hertfordshire, England, called Graham Young. He had been poisoning people, including family members, from the age of 14. But eventually, he poisoned someone using thallium, and it was so similar to the poisoning method used in her book.
Did she ever learn if, in fact, he had used her book as sort of a how-to?
There is a question about that. Scholars who've studied it think that he was more an habitual poisoner, more fascinated with chemistry than with her book, although when he was finally caught after a second spree of poisoning, he did talk about the fact that he had wanted to write a book and had notes for one. The interesting thing is that Christie's book also did save two lives documentedly. There was a nurse in England, who helped to diagnose an undiagnosed ailment in a child and save that child's life because she had read A Pale Horse. And also another reader of Agatha Christie saved the life of a friend in an attempted murder thanks to A Pale Horse.
Because how? He recognized the symptoms?
Recognized the symptoms.
And I'm just wondering, given what you've said about people sometimes copycatting or the suspicion that they might have be copycatting a mystery writer. Do authors sometimes obscure the details of poisoning, or do they try to get it, exactly right?
Well, I can think of one writer in England, Catherine Aird, who writes a rather cozy style mystery, and she is a daughter of a country doctor, and she makes sure that she doctors up the formula for any poisoning that she shows so that, in fact, if someone followed it, it would be harmless. I know, too, that Patricia Cornwell, with whom I've spoken on many occasions, was extremely upset when a method of murder, although not a poisoning method, was apparently employed by someone called Waterman in 1991, imitating a crime in post-mortem Patricia Cornwell's book. I know that that really concerns her, but I don't know that she changes any of the details of her forensics, because, of course, the forensic verisimilitude is so important to the work of a writer like that.
Right, and especially Cornwell. Well, and again, we don't know. It is known that Litvinenko was poisoned by polonium-210. It isn't known how, because he would have had to ingest it or have it come in through a wound. And so that is still a mystery, a real-life mystery. But I'm wondering, Rosemary Herbert, is this as odd to you, as tragic as it is it also as odd to you as it is to us? Or do you suspect that this happens more than we know?
I think it may happen more than we know. That may just be my literary and mystery writing imagination running away with me. I do think that there are those possibilities in the real world as well as in fiction.
Rosemary, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Robin. It's always lovely to be on the program.
Rosemary Herbert, co-editor of A New Omnibus of Crime and a mystery reviewer for The Washington Post, speaking to us about the literary versions of the real-life poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko. Still ahead, Carl Tanner, Here and Now. here and now. You could not have scripted it. Carl Tanner, a hopeful tenor from Virginia, comes to New York with $75 in his pocket and begins to sing O Holy Night in a restaurant where the director of the Santa Fe Opera happens to be dining. He offers Carl a role in a production that following summer.
Night, the stars are brightly shining. It is the night of our dear Savior's birth.
But wait, it gets better. Carl Tanner grew up crooning country music in a family of modest means before joining the school choir after a neighbor heard him singing in the shower. Or wait a minute, maybe it was after that music teacher told him Pavarotti made $6 million a year. Anyway, he then made his way to Shenandoah Conservatory, but there was little work, so he became a bounty hunter. Oh, wait, maybe it was a truck driver. And then, yes, as a truck driver, someone heard him singing through the rig window and said to him, "Go east, young man," and he had that fateful encounter in the restaurant.
Long lay the world in sin and error.
Anyway, he's now a rising opera star with a wonderful backstory who's sung O Holy Night at the White House Christmas tree lighting, and he's here to tell us more about Hear the Angel Voices, his new CD of Christmas songs. Carl Tanner, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay, is it all true? Are all the stories true?
You know, I couldn't write that stuff. yeah, it's all true. It's been a dream, and it's been a lot of hard work, but here we are.
Well, I just have this image of you, you know, with people pulling themselves up to your 18-wheeler window and saying, "Hey, you should be an opera singer."
Yeah, I was stopped in traffic at a light, and I just decided to sing along with, I think it was Placido Domingo at the time, singing E Lucevan le Stelle from Tosca. So I started singing along with him, and the lady started blowing her horn, and I kind of rolled down my window to yell something at her. I was a typical trucker then, and she kind of motioned to me, and I rolled down my window, and she said, "Was that you singing?" And I said, "Yeah, that was me singing, a little bit of me in the radio." And she said, "Well, you've missed your calling." And I kind of smiled and nodded, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And she said, "No, seriously, if you sing like that, you're not meant to drive a truck." So then I got home that night. My father, who, he was a country boy, and he only listened to country music. But he was flipping through his channels on his car that day, and he heard probably Placido Domingo singing the same thing. Because then he said to me, "Carl, honey, when are you going to go and be a singer?" And I said, "Well, Dad, it's a lot more difficult than that." And he said, "Well, honey, it's almost like, you know, God gave you this voice, but you don't want to use it." Then I thought, I said, "Okay, someone's trying to tell me something." Mm. So I went in the following Monday and gave him my 2 weeks, and they said, "Well, we're giving you a week." I said, "So you're firing me?" And they said, "Well, no, you just need to start this sooner." They paid me for 2 weeks, which was very sweet of them, and I went home and gave the money to my parents and moved to New York, and that was the start of it.
Went into that restaurant. What all those angels, you know, pushing you along the way, and then, of course, as we said, you happen to sing in a restaurant, you know, in front of the director of the Santa Fe Opera.
Of course, the Christmas album is called Hear the Angel Voices, but I was ignoring all those angels' voices.
Yeah.
Coming through my, you know, coming on the way to being a singer.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of those sounds. Here you are with a full choir featuring the Seattle Chorus and Northwest Boys Choir. This is Mille Cherubini. Have I said that right, Cherubini?
Correct.
Let's listen. Carl Tanner, can you just, I mean, that's your recorded voice. Can you back away from the mic and just, you know, sing out a little bit as you would when you were in the shower or in the car, just what these people were hearing that said to them, "You've got to make this a career." Can you do that?
You really want that right
now? Yeah.
Mia vita amante inquieta, dirò sempre.
Is that good?
Man, I would have driven you myself to New York had I heard that. Is it hard for you to switch from, you know, some of these, you know, epic operatic roles to Christmas songs, essentially?
When I'm singing Christmas music, I have music running through my soul for the whole month of December, even when I'm not singing it. It touches me that much. And it always has ever since I was a child. It's more than me. It chose me to sing it. And I know that sounds very strange, but it's something that I knew I'd do. It was a progression in my career that I just knew I'd have to, one day I'd record all this music.
You have one of my favorites on it. Let's listen. This is with the Northwest Sinfonia to Panis Angelicus.
Panis Angelicus, fit panis omnium, nat panis celicus, fit curis terminum.
Carl Tanner, you are also a big man. You are a star football player. Your coach, one of those who encouraged you to sing. But that makes me think of another twist in your story. We mentioned you are a truck driver. You were also a bounty hunter with a Beretta strapped to your ankle. You left that job after you were shot at, but you learned later that you'd helped change the life of the kid that shot you.
Correct. When I went after this kid, actually, went to the front door, and he just started taking pot shots at me with a .22 through the door. And by the grace of God, did I not get hit. I stood in the door frame, jumped off the porch. I heard his gun lock up. When he came out, I tackled him. I wrestled him to the ground. He was so little. He was a little wiry kind of guy. I handcuffed him. He slipped right out of the handcuffs and sucker punched me. So then I tied him in nylon ties, put him in my car, and gave him a speech all the way home. And he was very defiant. So finally, I had to pull the car over and threaten him. And I told him, the next time, if I ever run into you again, I will return fire, and I'm a great shot.
And you did run into him again, but it was years later. You feel this tap on your shoulder at a convenience store. You turn around, and there's this kid. And he says what to you?
He says, "Are you Officer Tanner?" I reached up, and I grabbed this Rolaids rack, a pretty heavy rack. And I was, you know, when someone asks that question, I have to protect myself. So I said, "Well, who's asking?" And he said, "Well, I think I was the only person to ever shoot at you." And I knew immediately who it was, and I said, "I'll wait for you outside." I think I was buying a Slurpee at a 7-Eleven. And we talked, and he actually thanked me. I think it was a culmination of God and many other things that straightened him out. But and he's married and has a child now, and he's really doing well, and he's been following my career, actually.
And Officer Tanner is appearing on the world stages as an opera singer. Carl Tanner, I smell movie. You know, it's such an incredible story. Has anybody ever suggested that you tell it in some sort of cinematic form?
Many people have talked about it. Some writers have actually thought about it, but I haven't thought about it. So we'll see. I mean, if it happens, that'd be great, and we'll see who could play my part.
Yeah. That's right. They'd have to be able to sing and carry a Beretta.
I'm hoping.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Carl Tanner's new CD of holiday songs is Hear the Angel Voices. For more, visit our website, hear-now.org, and it's early yet, but here's a little holiday spirit.
Repeat the sounding joy, repeat the sounding joy, repeat, repeat the sounding joy.
Well, the store started a week ago. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.